We have been in the middle of this series we started with the new year called Think Again, and we are examining a couple of verses in Philippians chapter 4 to ask the question, does it matter as Christians how we think and what we think about? The answer that the series will give us every single week again and again is a resounding yes. It matters tremendously how we think and what we think about. Because what we think about and how we think is a big part of how we continue to be formed as Christians, as maturing believers in Jesus. And so this morning we're going to move along to the second word found in that passage in Philippians 4. We're going to talk about whatever is noble. Whatever is noble. So before we get to thoughts on being and thinking in ways that are noble, let's read that passage in Philippians chapter 4, just verses 8 and 9, and you'll see that this morning's topic is highlighted. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Whatever you've learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. So today we talk about whatever is noble. So when you think about that word, when you hear me say the word noble, I want you to think about what sort of pops into your head. You don't have to answer out loud, but if I was to ask you, when I say the word noble, or some translations render it honorable, do you think of a person? Do you think of a role? Do you think of a thing? Do you think of a place? What comes into your mind when you hear the word noble? Because I'll tell you what comes into my mind, for better or worse, and I don't know exactly why, but whenever I hear the word noble, I think about a knight from medieval Europe for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because I've seen enough movies or whatever. I think of like Heath Ledger in A Knight's Tale, although I'm not sure how noble he really was in that movie, right? Or maybe Sean Connery in First Knight. Like, I think about just somebody like that. I think about a guy on a horse with a sword. That somehow that is a picture of what it looks like and to be noble. And maybe that's sort of kind of what some of you are thinking about as well. Well, would you be surprised to find out that that's not quite the idea of what it means to be noble in the biblical sense of Philippians chapter 4? So instead, I want you to think of this, right? Think about, and again, not answering out loud, just think about a person that you know, a person in your life with whom you could share anything, anything, and that person would never look at you with shock or disgust or push away from the table and leave the room. Do you have a person in your life that you could share the deepest, darkest, nastiest stuff that you have thought or done or said, and you know that that person would never be so shocked or disgusted at what you might tell them that they would push away from the conversation, that they would shut you out in shock or disgust? Because the biblical idea of being noble looks a lot more like that kind of person than a guy on a horse with a sword. And maybe you have that in your life. Maybe you have a spouse or a close friend or a sibling or a mentor. Or for some people, it's a counseling relationship where they have found out there is this person that I can unpack anything in front of them. And I know that they're never going to look upon me with disgusted judgment. They're going to sit with me in the middle of my mess and not be moved to walk away. The Greek word for noble or honorable in this passage is semnos, and it's actually more closely associated with the latter person than the former. That Greek word doesn't mean some guy on a horse with a sword. If you want to be a noble person, I promise, no horse is required, no sword is needed, because it's much different than that picture that many of us drum up inside of our minds. A few quotes this morning from Pastor Jamie Rasmussen, who wrote this book that sort of gave me the idea to preach this series of sermons. He says this about that Greek word. It's a word that was used originally by the ancient Greeks to describe the Greek gods like Zeus and Hermes. Semnos referred to their greatness and their majesty. It was used to convey their loftiness and their deserving honor and worship. But by the time it was picked up by the New Testament writers, the word had morphed into a term used to describe human beings who were marked by seriousness or solemnity. It carried with it the idea of gravity and weightiness, describing a person who was thoughtful and steady, a person not easily swayed by outward happenings. That's more of the biblical idea in Philippians 4 of being a noble or honorable person. Now, then we ask the question, where do we see this in Scripture? Now, the really easy answer is this, probably many of you know. In the life of Jesus, the ministry of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus, the actions of Jesus, we see this all over the place. That in the story of Jesus, this kind of thinking and acting was everywhere. Again, from Pastor Jamie, think of all the people with whom Jesus interacted. Matthew at the tax collector's booth. The unnamed woman who touched Jesus in the crowd in order to be healed. The paralytic who interrupted Jesus' teaching when his friends dropped him through the roof. What these interactions have in common is a non-reactionary Jesus. A Jesus filled with grace and understanding mixed with life-giving passion and truth. And the point for us is clear. Maturing Christians learn to think in a non-reactionary way. I mean, just think of those examples that he gives right there, and there are many more. Think about Jesus meeting Matthew at that tax collector's booth, or better yet, the party afterwards where Jesus is eating with Matthew and his fellow tax collectors, and all of a sudden the Pharisees outside are like, he eats with sinners. And Jesus, instead of losing control, he approaches those who are saying such things and says, listen, do you know who needs a doctor? It's not the healthy, it's the sick. Or when Jesus is touched by that unnamed woman, he doesn't get upset. He just wants to know who she is and see her face. Or my personal favorite from this set of three is when Jesus is in the middle of preaching or teaching, and all of a sudden, some guy gets lowered through the roof above him so that he could be healed. I don't know about Jesus, I mean, he always impresses me, but I try and put myself in that situation. Like, can you imagine if I'm in the middle of preaching and teaching right now and just chunks of the ceiling start flying away and somebody gets hoisted down and laid here in the middle of the platform? I'm not Jesus, so therefore I would say, hey, seriously? I've been working on this message for 2 weeks. Give me a moment, right? I would not be happy. But Jesus never reacts in a way other than with this idea of being noble, rooted, grounded, steadfast. We don't just see it in his life. We see it's expected of different kinds of people in the New Testament as well. 1 Timothy chapter 3 talks about deacons, like church leaders. Titus 2 talks about older men and women in the congregation. Leaders in Titus 2 need to have this trait. Parents are told to have this non-reactionary, noble trait, which how many parents out there have been like, boy, I needed a little more of that during this last week or last month or last year or whatever it was. And really, Christians in general, that word is tied there in 1 Timothy chapter 2 where it says, you know, pray for the leaders and the authorities over you. Why? So that you can live quiet and peaceful lives, lives of weightiness with gravity, so that you are not moved and blown around by everything that comes your way. So yes, we see it in the life of Jesus, but it's expected to be reflected in our lives as well. So then we ask this question, well, how do we do it? How do we train ourselves to think more in this manner, to think in a way that is noble, right? We're going to look at one verse this morning, one single verse. Trust me, there's enough in it that we will have plenty to talk about. One single verse that maybe starts to get into a little bit more a detail about what sort of things would it look like to start living a life that's more noble. And it's James chapter 1, verse 19, and it simply says this: everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. I've had conversations on and off for years now, a lot of times with my wife, and we've asked ourselves and each other, what does it look like for a Christian to be different from the world? I mean, we drive the same cars, we wear the same clothes, we go to the same grocery stores. I would argue that living out this type of thing would make us look so, so different from the world around us. To be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. Let's just talk about the first one first. Let's set it aside. We are quick with just about everything in life, or at least we want to be, but are we quick to listen? We want everything else to be quick. I'll never forget the first time I was using my new Dish Network system at my house, and we had the DVR, and I selected the show that I wanted to watch, and I said, go, and all of a sudden my machine says to me, would you like to enable AutoHop? And I said, tell me more. My machine basically said, would you not only like to fast forward the commercials, but would you like for me, I'm paraphrasing here, by the way, what would you like for me to automatically hop, boop, that's not the sound it makes, but that's how I feel in my heart. And it just automatically skips the commercials for me. I don't have to do a thing. I say go, and it simply goes, right? Because why not? I already get to fast forward commercials. Now I don't even have to do anything because if I fast forward them myself, I have to go click, 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 click. No, too far. Back, back, back. Right? But with AutoHop, boom, it lands me where I need to be. And maybe it's not the Dish Hopper. Maybe it's the Netflix. If you use the Netflix and you ever get in that position where you have to wait for the buffering, whew. Like, we want it immediately. If we click go and we have to buffer for 5 or 10 or 12 or 20, I mean, after 20 seconds, we just start to go, the world's broken! Because I have to wait. And it's not just our entertainment. Now we have mobile ordering at a lot of our restaurants, right? It used to be that if you didn't want to go all the way inside and order something and then move down and wait for it to come, you had this magical drive-through where you could just drive through and not have to walk inside, and it was way faster. Now you can get on your phone, go to their app, say, this is what I want, I'm paying for it on my device, and when I get there, I will simply walk in, it will be on a counter for me, I will pick it up, and I will leave. I won't even have to wait in line at the drive-thru anymore. Quick, fast, now. But are we quick to listen? I would argue, for the most part, we are not. I think we realize being quick to listen does not make our lives more convenient. If we're quick to listen, our lives actually get less efficient. And if we truly listen, then we might hear something that causes us to examine our own lives and think about changing something. And who needs that? We need to be quick to listen. Then there's the second one. I would say it's hard to be slow to speak in what I would label today as the hot take world. You guys familiar with this phrase, a hot take, right? It's a phrase that actually began in the television and movie industry. When they were filming a show or a movie, they would sort of go off script a little bit or run out of script, and they would just do a hot take, where just kind of fly by the seat of your pants, see what you can come up with, see what kind of happens. But they realized most of the time, those clips were not even used. Those hot takes weren't used because there wasn't much thought that went into them. There wasn't much that was put behind them, so they kind of got cast off to the side during the editing process. But today, a hot take isn't something we necessarily talk about with television and movies. It's actually something that's connected to journalism. I found the description, the definition on the web, and it's this. A hot take is a piece of journalistic commentary, often deliberately provocative, that is typically shallow and usually written on tight deadlines with little research or reporting and even less thought. I was like, oh, wow, that sounds really familiar. That's about like 98% of what I see. We live in this hot take world where you need to have an opinion, and it needs to be an immediate opinion. I think we're all held captive to this. Can I take a moment to set you free from something? Maybe some of you don't realize this, so I want to make sure that you know. You are not obligated to have an opinion on everything. Did you know that? Yeah, you actually don't have to have an opinion on everything, let alone an immediate opinion on everything that you then share with everyone you know via any channel that you have. But that is the world in which we live, where you are made to feel like, oh, no, no, you need to know what's happening, have an immediate opinion, and then broadcast that opinion to anyone you can through any means you have. So I just want to let you know, you are under no obligation to have an opinion about everything that you see or hear. It's simply not true. That's the hot take world saying, come and join us because the water's better here. It's actually not. So lastly, if we become quick to listen, slow to speak, I actually think that the slow to become angry part will be a natural result. It will take care of itself if we do the first two things together. We'll be slow to become angry if we can learn to be quick to listen and slow to speak. I do want to say this about becoming angry. Anger itself is not prohibited in Scripture. It's not. There's no place that says, therefore, thou shalt not be angry. However, when we read about anger in Scripture, it comes with a lot of clarification and a lot of warnings. Warnings like this: in your anger, do not sin. Why would it say that? Because you will want to. When you get angry, you will want to sin, right? Or it says, don't let the sun go down on your anger. Why do we read that there? Because you will want to. It is much easier to let the sun go down on your anger than to do the hard work of being reconciled with the person that you are sharing those angry thoughts and emotions. So anger is not prohibited, but boy, it has a lot of guardrails on it. And yes, Jesus got angry. I don't have time to go into the whole temple cleansing thing. It's an entire sermon, but I'll just say this. Jesus did not get angry because his personal rights were being insulted or offended. Jesus was angry because the character and worship of God by all people was being threatened. That's why he got angry and braided a whip and cleared the temple. If you want to know more about that whole thing, let's get coffee this week. It's an amazing story. But we are given really tight guardrails on being angry. I was thinking about anger, and it reminded me, I worked two or three summers, I worked a summer job during my early college years. I actually worked at a shop here in town with my dad. It doesn't exist. Well, it sort of does. It doesn't have the name. I worked at the electric furnace company for a couple summers, and as a college student, I knew nothing about tools, about construction, nothing like that. So I was really probably really bad at my job. But I have vivid memories, though, of going and working on these huge industrial furnaces that were probably, I mean, I would guess 7, 8, 9 feet tall. And sometimes I would get charged with going up on top to just double check and make sure everything was in the right places and the right whatever. And many times I would go up to do that work and I would find that I needed a hammer, but I didn't have a hammer with me. But I'm not climbing down 7, 8, or 9 feet to get a hammer and come back up. So I would find the best possible substitute hammer that I could, usually some sort of really heavy wrench or something like that. And I would start wailing away on this thing that needed a hammer. And 9 times out of 10, one of the old guys on the floor would come past and yell up to me, "Son!" Which I'm not sure if that was like a term of endearment, like "I think of you as son," or more like, "Hey, young guy." I think it's more of the latter. But they would yell, "Son! It ain't a hammer," is what they would yell at me. And they're right, like I'm using this as a hammer when it's really not a hammer at all. And that reminded me of this quote. I love this quote from Abraham Maslow. "I suppose it's tempting, if the only tool you have is a hammer, to treat everything as if it were a nail." And I think that this is the world we're sort of transforming into, where because we culturally, as a society, we are not quick to listen, we are not slow to speak, so we are quick to become angry, and anger is like the only tool we have, and so everything's a nail. Everything deserves anger, rage, whatever it is, because that's really the only tool we have in our tool belt most of the time as a culture, and it has nothing to do with the noble thinking that's talked about here in Philippians 4. I want to say one more clarification about that. Being noble and non-reactionary as a person does not mean you can't be passionate. You can still be a passionate person, but also be a noble, non-reactionary person. They are not mutually exclusive. Again, from Pastor Jamie, non-reactionary people still act, they just don't act in knee-jerk ways. Non-reactionary thinkers can be people with a lot of vision, tons of drive, a core of conviction that goes right to the center of their being. It's just that they apply thoughtfulness and wisdom and discernment before they act. You can still be a passionate, driven person without being a reactionary person who doesn't listen, who speaks to. You can still be passionate in the things that you do. And I think this idea of being a noble, non-reactionary person is tied to one other part of Scripture that we read on and off, especially in the New Testament, and that's the idea of self-control. I think that the pattern of noble and non-reactionary thinking and acting is closely associated with the idea of self-control, which we read in Scripture is both a fruit and a gift. So if you think about it, self-control is the ultimate edible arrangement. No? Yeah, I had to try it. I knew it was really bad, but I had to try it anyway. It is a fruit and it is a gift. Okay, it's a fruit from Galatians chapter 5. You know, the fruit of the Spirit is, self-control is one of them. But listen in 2 Timothy chapter 1, where we learn that it's also a gift. Fan into flame the gift of God which is in you, for the Spirit God gave us does not make us timid, but gives us power, love, and self-discipline. Power, love, and self-discipline. You read that and you go, yeah, fan into flame the gift you've received. The gift of power, yes, I like the gift of power. The gift of love, yes, the gift of love. The gift of self-discipline. Is there a return policy? That's not quite as exciting as the gifts of power and love. But it's one of the gifts we receive from the Spirit, the gift of self-discipline or the gift of self-control. Now, self-control in and of itself is not the end of the road, but I would put it this way. Self-control gives our brains space to breathe. That's how I would say it. When we exercise self-control, we sort of pause, we sort of step back, and our brains get some space to breathe. And I would argue that wisdom is what grows in that space that we create when we exercise self-control. It's self-control that allows wisdom to be grown by the Spirit in our lives. We create that space, and the Spirit of God brings into our lives wisdom and discernment. Listen to this passage in Proverbs chapter 4. Get wisdom. Get understanding. Do not forget my words or turn away from them. Do not forsake wisdom, and she will protect you. Love her, and she will watch over you. Though it cost all that you have, get understanding. Cherish her, and she will exalt you. Embrace her, and she will honor you. What I love about that passage and the way it teaches us about wisdom is what I would call wisdom that is over and underneath. Because it says, get wisdom, and she will watch over you. Almost like a shield, almost like this protective element in your life. As you exercise self-control and wisdom grows, it becomes a shield. But it also is the underneath, because it says wisdom will exalt you. Wisdom will lift you up, and something that lifts you up has to be underneath of you. And so as we exercise self-control and we see wisdom growing in our lives, it will both protect us and lift us up to live the lives we're called to live as noble people. And slowly, sometimes very, very slowly, as we listen more and think before we speak and holster our anger and exercise self-control and allow wisdom to accumulate in our lives, we will become the kind of non-reactionary people we talked about at the beginning, the people we're drawn to. We will become those sort of people, rooted, steadfast, people with gravity, not easily shocked or swayed. We become the kind of people that would be described as noble people. And so with that in mind, as we finish up our time, let's consider a couple of ways to reflect on this and maybe apply it to our lives. Here's the first one. How reactionary are you when you find yourself in tense, shocking, or threatening situations, or around what I would call troubling personalities? That's about the nicest way I could come up with expressing that. How reactionary are you in those situations? Secondly, which of the three challenges from James 1:19 is the most difficult for you? Being quick to listen, or being slow to speak, or being slow to get angry? And maybe some of you are going, I have to choose, because all three of those are hard. But maybe there's one that's just especially difficult for you. Third, is there an area of your life that fills you with passion and drive that might easily cross over into reactionary anger if we don't exercise self-control and grow wisdom? And then lastly, during our time of silent reflection, I invite you to do this. Think about the day-to-day schedule of your upcoming week. Under which circumstances or with which people will you likely have an opportunity to exercise self-control in order to allow the Spirit to grow wisdom in your life? So take just a moment or two to read through those words, to pray. If you want to close your eyes or bow your head, you're welcome to do that. But we want to allow some space for some silence for the Spirit to speak to each of our hearts. And then I will close that silent time with a word of prayer.